nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
Okay, let's wrap up the discussion on cofactors now. Quickly recapping, we hopefully are all convinced that cofactors are can be a very useful operation on Boolean functions. It's a new operation that we haven't, most of you, I presume, have not heard of before, right? Unlike the simple operations like AND, OR, NOT, and so on, in the case of cofactors, they're also simple. You derive the cofactor of a function with respect to a variable by simply fixing that variable to a constant, either constant 0 or constant 1, and that gives you the negative and positive cofactors, respectively. What makes cofactors interesting and useful is the various applications of cofactors. One of them which, that we reviewed, which was Shannon's expansion. Shannon's expansion is basically a way to recursively divide and conquer, divide Boolean functions into simpler functions of fewer variables, and you can keep doing that recursively. And the Boolean, we also started looking at other applications of cofactors, one of which is the Boolean difference, which is a new operation that results from taking the XOR of the positive and negative cofactors of a function with respect to the same variable, right? And we saw how Boolean difference could be useful. Today, we'll be talking about two more applications of cofactors, which are referred to as universal and existential quantification, respectively. And to motivate the, or to introduce these, I'll essentially start off by noting that we got the Boolean difference by taking the XOR of f sub x and f sub x prime. You can think of, you know, other operators to combine f sub x and f sub x prime, the most intuitive being the logical and logical OR, and that is precisely what is going to lead us to these two operations. So what happens when you take the AND of f with respect to xi and the f with respect to xi prime? Well, if you this is known as the universal quantification or consensus of f with respect to the variable xi. And it's written as shown on the right. There are two alternative notations, both of which are equivalent. The top notation is for all x of f. And the bottom notation is consensus with respect to f, consensus of f with respect to a variable, in this case x or a, whatever the variable is. So cx of f and for all x of f are both exactly the same thing. They refer to the consensus. And what it is the AND, the logical AND of the cofactors of f with respect to x and x prime. Okay. Intuitively, what does this mean? It actually tells you when f equals 1 independent of the value of x, right? Because, you know, f sub x I and f sub x I prime give you, essentially give you the function f when x is set to a 0 and x is set to a 1 respectively. You can think of those are as sort of restricted versions of f, in corresponding the cases when xi equals 0 and xi equals 1. And when you take the AND of the two, what that new function tells you is, again, it's a function of n minus 1 variables, if you started off with the f as a function of n variables, and the new function tells you when the original f was going to be 1, independent of no matter what the value xi took, under those conditions of the other variables, f would always be a 1. The geometric interpretation hopefully should reinforce that intuition. So here's an example. In the Boolean hypercube notation of f equals ab plus bc or ac. Again, as usual, the red vertices are the onset vertices, the light blue vertices are the offset vertices. And if you, in order to compute the consensus, you first need to take the cofactor. So in this case, let's pick variable a. F sub a is b or c. F sub a prime is bc. Again, just set a to 1 and 0 respectively in that expression, and you get these cofactors. So the consensus of f with respect to a is nothing but f sub a and f sub a prime, which is b or c and bc. And the result, if you do the usual Boolean simplification, apply the laws of Boolean algebra and simplify that resulting Boolean expression, it turns out to be nothing other than bc itself. Okay. So the consensus of f with respect to a is bc. If you look at this new function, which is, of course, it's only a function of two variables, b and c, but for comparison with f, we will draw it out in the same three-dimensional Boolean space consisting of a, b, and c. If you look at the onset of this function, it corresponds to these two vertices here, right? So can anybody notice the pattern here? If you compare the onset vertices of the consensus function with respect to the onset vertices of the original function, what sort of relationship do you see? Well, if you look at
the two vertices that remain, notice that these two vertices that remain in the onset were both in the onset of the original function, and they were neighbors along the A dimension. In other words, you know, this vertex corresponds to BC A prime, and this vertex corresponds to ABC, right? A equals 0, B and C are 1. A equals 1, B and C are 1. So the only difference in terms of the variable values between these two vertices is A, which is precisely the variable you're taking, trying to take the consensus of F with respect to. Okay? So the interpretation essentially is, if you look at the original onset, all the vertices in the onset of F, look at vertices, pairs of vertices which are neighbors in the A dimension. What does that mean? You know, geometrically, it's easy to think of. You take any vertex, essentially, you may either look at the vertex to its left or to the right, depending on where it lies, and that is going to be the neighbor in the, along the A dimension, right? Algebraically, it is essentially pairs of vertices where that differ only in the value of A. So, values of B and C are the same in both, for both vertices. A is 0 and 1 in one and the other, respectively. So, if you look at these pairs of vertices that are neighboring in the A dimension, we are only keeping, in the consensus function, we are only keeping those vertices where in the original function, both those neighbors in the A dimension were both in the onset. Anytime where you have one of the vertices, if you look at the A neighbors here, for example, one of these vertices in the onset, other is in the offset, we throw them away here from the onset of the function. So keep vertices where F equals 1 independent of A. In other words, keep vertices whose neighbors in the A dimension are also in the onset. Okay. That is the geometric interpretation of the consensus or universal quantification. Any questions on this? Okay, if not, we'll also look at it from the circuit point of view. The circuit interpretation follows rather directly from the definition. You have the cofactor of F with respect to Xi, in this case, is the variable you're trying to take the consensus of F with respect to Xi. You take the cofactor with respect to Xi, cofactor with respect to Xi prime by setting it to a zero, and then take the AND, the outputs of these two blocks, take the logical AND of the two, and that gives you C sub Xi of F. Right? So, one of the functions that I wanted to talk about was the universal quantification or consensus. The other function, known as existential quantification, also known as smoothing, results by taking the logical OR of the two cofactors of F with respect to any variable. So what this says is F sub X or F sub X prime is denoted as there exists X of F, also known as smoothing of F with respect to A. Ideally for, think of A as X. You know, A is just another variable. I should probably change this to X to make sure that we are just consistent. So think of both these, the C X of F and S X of F. Just a different way of writing the same thing. Okay. So what does this tell you? This tells you when the conditions for which F equals 1 for at least one value of Xi. In other words, either when Xi equals 0 or when Xi equals 1, there exists at least one value of Xi such that setting it to that value will make the original F equals 1. Right? Let's again look at the geometric interpretation to reinforce that intuition. So again, this is the same function as before. F equals AB or BC or AC with the hypercube representation. The cofactors are also same as before. The only difference now is we take F sub A or F sub A prime, and that is nothing but B or C or BC. And again, applying the basic laws of Boolean algebra, you notice that this BC term becomes redundant, and the result is nothing but B or C. Okay? So the smoothing or existential quantification of F with respect to A is B or C. Now let's again look at the geometric interpretation of this. What have we done? If you compare the onset, we plotted the smoothing function on the same three-dimensional hyperspace. And if you compare the onset of this function with the onset of the original function f, what do you see? Well, we see that there are two new onset vertices in the smoothing function. And those onset vertices were originally offset vertices in the original F, but they had neighbors in the onset. Neighbors in the A dimension again, right? So we only are looking at the variable with respect to which we are taking the smoothing. So if you look at an offset vertex here, the vertex here, for example, which corresponds to A equals 0, B equals 0, and C equals 1, the vertex here, it has an A neighbor along the A dimension, which is in the onset. Therefore, this vertex also is brought into the onset of F, of the smoothing function. Similarly, if you look at the vertex here, which corresponds to B equals 1, A equals 0, C equals 0, again, it has a neighbor along the A dimension, which is in the onset of F, so it is also brought into the onset of the smoothing function. Okay. So in a sense, you're expanding the onset of F by looking at onset vertices and looking at their neighbors. If they are in the offset originally in F, bring them into the onset here. Okay.
So in this original function, if the bottom red onset was originally off, then this would have disappeared?
Well, if you mean if this one was off, wasn't the offset?
A, B, C prime, yes.
Right.
If that was offset.
And this was also, and everything else was the same?
Yeah, so okay. If the smoothing, then the bottom one that you have encircled would have
been... Would not have been in the onset either. Yeah, that's correct. So so the question is, if this vertex right here were originally in F, imagine this were in the offset, would this vertex, its neighbor, then have been moved to the onset? And the answer is no. Right, because you can look at these two vertices to give you an example of that. Right, both the A neighbors, the neighbors in the A dimension, are originally in the offset and they remain in the offset. Right, so when you have both in the onset, like here, you just copy them over to be both in the onset. There's no change. When you have both in the offset, again, there's no change. Only when you have one in the onset and one in the offset, that is the case where you have a change. You see a difference, and in that case, the offset vertex is moved into the onset. The circuit interpretation, again, is relatively straightforward. As before, you have these two copies of F set the input of interest, xi, to 1 and 0, respectively, and the outputs are the cofactors, positive and negative cofactors, and you take the OR of the two, and that gives you the smoothing. So consensus and smoothing are essentially two new functions. Right? Just like the cofactor itself was a new function, consensus and smoothing are also two new functions of fewer variables. You start off with a function, and these are derived functions of n minus 1 variables, if you started off with a function of n variables. So there are some interesting properties of consensus and smoothing functions, or these operators, that we should keep in mind. First is, like cofactoring itself, much like cofactoring, which we said could be applied with respect to multiple variables, therefore consensus and smoothing can also be applied with respect to multiple variables. So if you look at, for instance, the first line out here, I have the consensus with respect to x and y, two variables of the function f. Similarly, the smoothing with respect to x and y of f. And as with cofactors, you can derive the consensus and smoothing with respect to multiple variables by doing it one variable at a time. So you can take, and the order does not matter. So you can take, for instance, to get c sub xy of f, you can take first consensus with respect to y, and then take the answer, and then take its consensus with respect to x, or do it in the other way around, other order. So first take it with respect to x, and then with respect to y. And the answer you get will be the same. Okay. Similarly, for smoothing, also, the order in which you can do smoothing with respect to multiple variables by doing it one variable at a time in any order. Okay. So that's one interesting property. And the other interesting property is known as the containment property. Essentially states that the consensus of a function f with respect to any of its input variables is contained in f. And in this context, it helps to think of functions in terms of their onset. So a function is a set of vertices or set of minterms that constitute its onset, right? So if you look at the onset of the consensus function, it is a subset of the onset of the original function, right? And intuitively, that should make sense from our geometric view that we had before, right? Where we threw away some vertices from the onset in order to get the consensus. So strictly, either you keep all the vertices or you're shrinking, you never expand the onset. So it's a subset. Similarly, the smoothing of a function with respect to any variable contains the original function's onset itself. So put equivalently stated mathematically, the consensus with respect to x of any function f is contained in f, which in turn is contained in the smoothing of function with respect to the same variable x. So the consensus operation essentially either leaves the onset unchanged or shrinks it. The smoothing operation either leaves the onset unchanged or expands it. Let's work through a couple of quick examples for consensus and smoothing to reinforce the concept. So we'll start off the full adder. Start off by writing the logic expressions for the outputs of the full adder. As we know, the sum is A XOR B XOR C in. And the carry out is AB or BC in or AC in, right? These are the expressions for the outputs of the full adder. Oops, not a good idea, I guess. Okay, I'll just work around them. All right. So first, let's take the consensus or universal quantification of the sum with respect to A. In order to do that, we first need to compute the cofactors, right? We did this already in the last class, and we saw that S sub A is derived by setting A to 1, which is nothing but B XNOR C in, right? And S sub A prime, we already saw, which is derived by setting A equals 0, is nothing but B XOR C in, right? So these are the cofactors, positive and negative cofactors, and how do you derive the consensus from the positive and negative cofactors? You take the logic AND of these two. So what you need to do is take, to get for all A of S, U is SA and SA prime. However, we know that the XNOR is nothing but the complement of the XOR, and anything AND its complement is 0. Therefore, for all A of S is the 0 function. Intuitively, what does that tell you? It tells you that there is no possible value of the other variables B and C in such that you can force the sum to be a 1 independent of the value of A. Right? Because that's exactly what this is. What are the value? This is a function of the other two variables B and C in. And this tells you when the original function S is going to be a 1 independent of the value of Cn, no matter what value it takes. Independent of the value of A, no matter what value A takes. Right? And what this tells you is that there does not exist any set of values that you can set, and the other on the side inputs of the adder, that will force the sum output to a 1 independent of one of the inputs. And hopefully that is intuitively corresponds to your understanding of how a full adder works. Right? Now, by symmetry, you know, because this function is symmetric in all its variables, we can similarly, you can go through the derivation, but you will also see that the consensus with respect to C in of S will also be 0. Okay. Now, for the carry out, we look at in this case, we are asked to derive the existential quantification or smoothing of carry out with respect to A and C in respectively. So again, we need to start off by taking the cofactors. So the C out with respect to A is nothing but B or C in. C out with respect to A prime, the cofactor, negative cofactor is B and C in. And therefore, the existential quantification of C out with respect to A is nothing but the logical OR of these two, right? So that is B OR CN or BCN. But again, from the basic laws of Boolean algebra, we know that this term is redundant, so the answer is nothing but B OR CN. Okay? So what that tells you is that if this is true, B OR CN is true, then there exists at least one value of A which will make the carry out 1. Doesn't tell you which value that is going to be, but it just tells you there is one value, at least one value of A, which will make your original carry out 1. Okay. Similarly, again, by symmetry, you can go through the derivation as a homework exercise, but you can, just by symmetry, we can also observe that the existential quantification of the carry out with respect to carry in is nothing but A or B. Right? So again, this tells you that if A or B are 1, if at least one of these two are 1, then there exists at least one value of Cn that will make C out also equal to 1. Okay. I'll let you work through the other example as a homework exercise. In this case, it's a multiplexer. Similarly, try to derive the consensus or universal quantification of the output of the multiplexer with respect to one of the data inputs, as well as with respect to the select input, and similarly the existential quantification as well. Okay, so I leave that to you as a homework exercise. Do try it out and ask me a question in class next time if you'd like me to go over it. But it should be pretty straightforward along similar lines. Start off with the cofactors, and in this case, take the logic AND of the cofactors. In this case, take the logic OR of the cofactors. Yes?
For the consensus function, for in our case, both of them we had zero. If there was a value, then physically, what would it have meant?
The consensus means, so if, let's look at maybe... Maybe we will work out one of those examples to show you what it would mean, right? So I'm going to erase this and start off with the output of the multiplexer, as we know, is S prime A or S B. And we want to do the consensus with respect to A of out. It's nothing but out cofactored with A and out cofactored with A prime, right? That in turn is nothing but S prime or SB and SB. And we know that this term gets cancelled out because it's S prime and S is zero, so this is nothing but SB. So here's an example where the consensus is non-zero, right? So the consensus of the output of a multiplexer with respect to one of its inputs is, in particular, the zero input is S and B. So what does this tell you? If S equals 1 and B equals 1, what is the output of the multiplexer going to be? It's always going to be 1. Do you need to know the value of A in order to conclude the output? No. So what this tells you is that the output is always going to be 1 under these conditions, under SB, independent of the value of A. Right. And that is precisely the interpretation of consensus that we gave when we defined it. Right. So it tells you when the function is a 1, independent of that variable with respect to which you're taking the consensus. Okay, so do work out the other questions as homework exercise and let me know if you have any questions or problems. So that brings us to the end of the module on advanced Boolean algebra. We did a quick recap of basic Boolean algebra and then moved on to talk about Boolean spaces and Boolean functions, which are defined in terms of as mapping between Boolean spaces. We talked about different representations of Boolean functions. If you recall, we started off with truth table and then talked about Boolean formulae and then specifically talked about sum of products and product of sums. And then also talked about binary decision trees and binary decision diagrams. These are some of the myriad of representations that are available to you when you're choosing to represent a Boolean function. We've talked about certain operations on Boolean functions. In particular, we paid special attention to cofactors and their applications, one of which is Shannon's expansion, which gives you a way of recursively dividing a Boolean function in terms of its cofactors. But we also talked about the Boolean difference, which is a new operator which you get by taking the XOR of the cofactors. And we, in this lecture, also talked about existential and universal quantification, also known as smoothing and consensus, respectively, right? Which result from taking the logic OR and logic AND of the two cofactors of a function. Okay, so that brings us to the end of the discussion on advanced Boolean algebra. Hopefully, and from now onwards, we'll actually dive into using some of these concepts in different design automation steps. And hopefully as we go through the rest of the course, you will see various points where especially consensus and the cofactors and the different operations defined in terms of cofactors will be used again and again. The reading for the next module is going to be, which is two-level synthesis, the reading for the next module is, for your information, DiMichele chapters 7.1 to 7.4 and 7.7, or in case you're following the Hacton and Swimensee book at chapters 4 and 5 there. Okay, so now we start a new module. This is on two-level logic synthesis. In this module, we're going to be revisiting a classical problem. Now, hopefully a problem that is familiar to most of you. And you've all seen from your digital design class, all of you have seen, hopefully have seen truth tables and Karna maps, and you all learned how to manually create, using pen and paper, create minimal two-level implementations or sum of products implementations of Boolean functions using Karna maps, right? What we are going to be learning here now in this class is how the same thing can be done automatically. In other words, if you had to write a program, a computer program, that read in a specification of a Boolean function and generated an optimal, a minimized two-level implementation, how would you do that? How do you go about writing the program? What are the algorithmic techniques you'll use in order to make this thing scalable so that you can handle very large functions? Okay, so that's going to be the focus of our discussion here. Before we go into the technical concepts, as always, I like to start with a historical perspective. So a brief history of two-level minimization. This is certainly one of the problems in logic-level design automation that has the richest history, right? It is perhaps the first classical design automation problem. The initial ideas in this field originated from Willard Quine, who was a philosopher and logician. He basically lived for most of the 20th century. And as you know, from Boole's papers, for those of you who had a chance to look at that, at that point in time, logic was considered a branch of philosophy, right? People were really thinking, people who studied logic were really trying to understand how the human mind worked and how we took facts and propositions and, you know, used them together to derive new concepts or new conclusions, right? And Boole was the first person to relate logic to mathematics and said that there could be some algebraic structure, you know, to this field and made it more of a science. Quine's ideas were mostly captured in these two fundamental papers that he published, one in 1952, which is titled The Problem of Simplifying Truth Functions, published in the American Mathematical Monthly, and followed it up with another paper a few years later, 1955, also titled similarly, A Way to Simplify Truth Functions. Right? So these are the papers that set out the original ideas that started this topic of two-level minimization. And an interesting tidbit about Quine, although the technologies he developed, concepts he proposed, were quite instrumental in enabling computers to be designed. Again, going back to the video from IBM that I had forwarded, many of you may have seen that some of their early mainframe computers heavily used two-level implementations of all of the logic and drove the need for two-level logic minimization. He never used a computer, even though, you know, most of his technologies were used to build computers, always used this typewriter, the 1927 Remington typewriter that he had originally used for his PhD thesis, because he needed to use so many mathematical symbols and in that document, he actually had to remove some of the keys in order to add certain new keys. And among the keys he removed were, you know, the second, for those of you who are familiar with the typewriter layout, you know that there's two periods, two full stops and two commas. He got the second ones removed and he completely eliminated the question mark. And one of the reporters actually asked him, don't you miss the question mark? And he said, you see, I deal in certainties. Quine's ideas were fairly shortly after they were proposed. They were picked up by a young researcher at AT&T Bell Labs by the name of Edward McCluskey. He published his paper in the Bell System Technical Journal, which was the internal technical journal of Bell Labs, titled The Minimization of Boolean Functions. And he based his concepts or his techniques proposed in that paper on the initial ideas due to Quine. And you could argue that the ideas proposed in this paper, which came to be known later as the Quine-McCluskey algorithm, were really the first algorithm suitable for implementation as a program. In other words, this was the first systematic procedure that could be done using or implemented, coded up using a computer program to minimize logic functions. And my own connection to McCluskey is sort of, you know, he's actually part of my academic lineage. He's my academic great-grandfather. Okay, moving on. The Quine-McCluskey method actually was a significant advance in the problem of two-level minimization. It remained the state of the art for over two decades. And in fact, even today, it forms the basic underpinning of most state-of-the-art two-level minimizers. Okay. So for over two decades, there was no, you know, a notable advance. But gradually, the increasing scale of integration and circuit complexity, right, number of transistors in these circuits that people were designing, grew to a point where there was a need for more efficient algorithms. And notably, in the early to mid-1970s at IBM, there was this program called Mini developed, which was a two-level, a heuristic two-level optimizer. Okay. And then followed what many people consider to be the golden age of research in logic synthesis and perhaps logic-level design automation, which was basically the mid-80s to the mid-90s. And in the first part of that era, there were three major efforts towards two-level minimization, roughly concurrent. One of them originated from IBM with Bob Brayton, who was a scientist at IBM, a mathematician, and then later on became a professor at UC Berkeley, where he still is today. They developed a series of software programs called Espresso, which performed both exact and heuristic two-level minimization. Okay, and we'll see in a minute what that means, what exact and heuristic means. But many of the ideas that they proposed are described in this 1984 book. Concurrently, there was an effort underway in Canada, I believe this is at McGill University, to develop a program that resulted in the development of a program called MechBool, which was published in the Design Automation Conference in 1985, and also addressed the same problem of two-level minimization. And concurrently in Europe, at the Catholic University of Leuven and IMEC in Belgium, they developed a software program known as Prestol, called Prestol 11, which was also targeted at the problem of two-level minimization. So these were roughly concurrent efforts. Most of the subsequent concepts and software in two-level minimization built on these efforts in one way or the other. And most of the concepts we are going to be talking about in class essentially are based on Espresso. Okay. Interestingly, Espresso, you know, was a huge advance, both in terms of conceptually and the scale of problems that scale of circuits that they could handle, and they also took the strategy of releasing their software to the entire research community. So everybody else sort of built their concepts and techniques on top of Espresso. So Espresso formed a foundation for, you know, the subsequent research, and so we will be talking about, you know, many of the concepts we'll be talking about in this module derived from Espresso. To date, some of those concepts that I mentioned remain the state of the art in two-level minimization, right? However, advances in Boolean function representations, and in particular implicit representations such as BDDs, binary decision diagrams, which we briefly talked about in the previous module, made it possible to perform exact two-level minimization for larger circuits than was ever possible before. Of course, computers get more and more powerful, and that, you know, gradually increases the scope of or scale of circuits you could handle, but BDDs brought about a quantum jump in the scale of circuits that you could minimize. Exactly. So exact minimization in this context, I'd like to give you a brief definition of what exact versus heuristic minimization is. In exact minimization, you're guaranteed to get the best possible solution. Right, so you are looking for the exact answer to an optimization problem. In general, whenever you have an optimization problem, if your answer is optimal, that is also referred to as an exact algorithm. In contrast, you have heuristic techniques or heuristic algorithms, which give you, in practice, good enough results, or, you know, on various benchmark circuits, they're demonstrated to perform close to optimal. For benchmarks for which you can run both, they actually have been shown to be pretty good. But in general, they are not guaranteed to be optimal. So heuristic techniques, such as the ones that are incorporated in Espresso and we'll talk about in class, you know, still remain the de facto standard because, you know, no matter what, at core, as we will see, this is a NP-complete problem and you cannot have any polynomial time exact algorithm that's going to work in all cases. So, you know, if you would like an algorithm to be scalable and to be guaranteed to run in a reasonable amount of computation time for all possible circuits, you need to resort to heuristic techniques. Okay, with that brief history, let's jump into the problem itself. First, let's define the two-level minimization problem. What do we mean by two-level minimization? Given a Boolean function, let's say, specified as a truth table or specified in some form, derive a minimum two-level sum of products implementation. Okay. So we know that sum of products is nothing but a representation of a Boolean function where you have a bunch of product terms which are all logically OR together, and each product term itself is the conjunction or logic AND of a bunch of literals. Right? What does minimum mean? So before we can actually solve this problem, we need to define it clearly. What do we mean by minimum? And there is multiple ways in which you can define minimum, but the two most common ways that are used to define a minimum sum of products implementation are fewest product terms and fewest literals. In this context, a literal, as we know, is one instance or one appearance of a variable in the true or complemented form, in either form, is counted as one literal. For example, if you have this sum of products representation of function shown here, you have, how many product terms do you have here? Four product terms. Each of these is one product term. So 1, 2, 3, and 4. How many literals are there? You just count all appearances of all variables in positive or negative form, right? Or complemented or uncomplemented form. So you will see that there are 2 + 3 + 3 + 3, which is a total of 11 literals, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Okay. So just count the appearances, all appearances of variables, and that gives you the number of literals in the sum of products expression. So when we say that we are trying to derive a minimum sum of products implementation, it can either mean it has the fewest possible product terms. That's one possible interpretation of minimum. Another possible interpretation of minimum is that this has fewest possible literals appearing in the expression. Okay. And both are valid, as we will see. Any questions about the formulation itself? Yes.
If you're counting every appearance,
yes,
then suppose we had the same expression with C prime replaced by C. So
it would not matter.
It would not matter. Yeah. Even though we require one less NOT gate.
That's right. We will. So that's a good question. Your question is about, you know, is there any benefit from if you have all variables in the expression appearing only in complemented form or only in uncomplemented form? And the reason for that question should become apparent in the next slide. But the way we are defining the problem here, it does not matter. Yes, you would save an inverter, but that's a constant savings. It's not really, you know, the dominant component of the function's implementation cost. Okay. So this should clarify what the question was about. But before we get to that, two-level minimization was driven by an implementation style for logic functions, right? For quite a few years, and even today for certain specific logic functions, the implementation style of choice for combinational logic was known as PLA, or Programmable Logic Array. So what is a PLA? A PLA essentially consists of, you know, you have certain input variables and certain functions that you wish to compute. For example, here the logic expressions F0 is X0, X1, or X2 prime. F1 is X0, X1, X2, or X2 prime, or X0 prime, X1. These are two-level sum of products expressions that relate F0 and F1 to the variables X0, X1, and X2. You can take such an expression and directly translate it to an implementation where you start off the input variables and you have the variables and their complements being fed into one level of the programmable logic array, or PLA, known as the AND plane, and we'll see exactly why it's called AND plane in a minute. But the AND plane essentially feeds the so-called product terms, which are subsequently used in the OR plane in order to compute the functions F0 and F1. And in order to take advantage of the fact that N transistors are inherently slightly more efficient than P transistors, you will see essentially why the functions are generated as their complements, and then that's why you need this final set of inverters. But Pratik's question was that if you have a variable needed only in the positive form or only in the complemented form, you could potentially do away with one inverter here. That is correct, but the two-level minimization formulation as we have defined it does not consider that. You could modify it to consider that fact as well. Okay. It's very common in order to take advantage of the inherent efficiency of N-type devices or NMOS transistors to transform the AND-OR expression, the two-level AND-OR expression, using De Morgan's laws, into equivalently into a NOR-NOR expression, Okay, so you, as you'll see here, you expressed the two levels, the same expressions as two levels of logic. The first level of logic is a NOR gate here, a NOR of x0 prime and x1 prime, and the second level is again another NOR gate of the outputs of the first level of NOR gates. Okay, so the AND-OR expression can be translated into a NOR-NOR expression, which lends to an efficient implementation as shown here. Right. So again, you have the inputs and their complements. I have not shown the inverters here on the input or the output side, but basically you have the input variables and their complements being fed into the AND plane, and you have this array of transistors which basically generate the product terms. Each row here can be thought of as one of the product terms involved in either of these functions. And depending on which product terms are combined to generate F0 and F1, you have transistors in the OR plane appropriately to combine those product terms in order to give you the complement of F0 and F1, which eventually you will add inverters to and create F0 and F1. So going back to our cost function, we said we want to use product terms and literals to as the objective function, as the way of defining minimum. Why is that? Why does that make sense? If you look at the actual implementation that was commonly used for such functions, you will see that the number of transistors in the AND plane is nothing but the number of total number of literals in those original expressions that you had. So for every appearance of a variable or its complement, you would end up having requiring one transistor here in the AND plane. So naturally, this is a very natural cost function to take the number of literals, because if you have fewer literals, you'll have fewer transistors in the AND plane. The number of product terms, on the other hand, corresponds to the number of rows or the height of this PLA, one dimension of the PLA. Right? So if you look at each of these horizontal wires here, it corresponds to one of the product terms. Having fewer product terms would naturally lead to a more compact PLA. Okay? So this is exactly why, this is the reason why product terms and literals are used as the cost function to drive two-level minimization. We don't really need to understand how the transistor-level implementation works for this class, okay? But I just wanted to show you the implementation to motivate the fact that these are valid metrics to consider. Any questions? Okay. If not, we'll also I'll conclude by also remarking that you can take the same sum of products expressions and translate them directly into CMOS, complex CMOS gates, right? By taking the sum of products expressions and deriving series parallel networks of transistors for your pull-up and pull-down network to derive any function. Of course, this is not scalable beyond a small number of inputs, because these gates, from a delay point of view, don't perform very well once you have long series of paths. But you could conceptually do this. And again, if you compute the number of transistors in a complex CMOS implementation of a function, in terms of the number of in terms of the sum of products expression, you will see that the number of transistors in this case, for example, you have, how many literals do you have in this sum of products expression? 11 literals, right? 4 plus 4 plus 3. And if you count the number of transistors in either the pull-up or pull-down network, you will see that is exactly equal to 11. That's not a coincidence. The pull-up and pull-down network are derived in a straightforward direct, as a direct one-to-one translation of this expression. And therefore, the number of transistors in this complex CMOS implementation of the function is 2 times the number of literals in that expression. So again, it helps to minimize the number of literals. Okay. Having justified the metrics that we will use, let's now dive into some of the techniques, basic techniques that are used for two-level minimization. In order to do that, we'll briefly recap some terminology that we studied in the previous module. We've talked about cubes, implicants, and covers, right? So cube is nothing but a conjunction of literals. So you have a bunch of literals, which could be either the variables or their complements. You take the conjunction of those literals, and that's a cube. And we've seen that a cube is a subspace, can also be thought of as a subspace of a Boolean space, right? So if you have a Boolean space B to the n, any conjunction of those n or fewer literals is a cube. It can also be thought of as a subset of the vertices of that space. An implicant of a function is a cube that is contained in the function's onset. For example, the function here is shown in terms of its onset vertices, and either the ovals here that group two onset vertices together, there's three such ovals. Each of them represents a cube, and they represent the cubes AB, BC, and AC respectively. And all of these are implicants of the function f, because they only include points from the onset of f. The cover of a function is a set of cubes that contains all the minterms from the onset of f but does not contain any of its offset. In other words, the cover accurately represents the function. A cover also directly translates to a sum of products implementation, because each cube is nothing but a product term, and you take the disjunction of those product terms, and that is a valid SOP for f. In other words, if you take AB or BC or AC, that is a sum of products expression for this function f. So far, we've talked about functions as being completely specified. In other words, for all the points in the input space, b to the n, the points are classified as either onset or offset points. This is the point, this is the time when we discuss two-level minimization, that, where we need to move on to incompletely specified functions, where you also have don't cares, right? Don't cares could arise due to multiple reasons, but for whatever reason, you don't really care what the value of the function is for some combinations of inputs, and therefore they are denoted as don't cares. So we'll simply extend the representation we've been using thus far with the Boolean hypercube. We will add a third color of vertex, in this case gray, to represent the don't care. So in other words, onset vertices will be marked as red, as always, as usual. Offset vertices will be marked as light blue, but we will also include gray to indicate don't cares. You can also algebraically write a function f, an incompletely specified function f, as a mapping from b to the n to the set of symbols 0, 1, and star. Previously, we said f, a Boolean function, is a mapping from b to the n to b. Now, we are extending that to say that it's a mapping to a set of three symbols, where the third symbol we've added is star, which is nothing but the don't care symbol. And from a geometric point of view, a function partitions the Boolean space into three subsets, right? Three strictly non-overlapping subsets. The onset, the offset as before, and the don't care set. The onset is denoted as f superscript 1, offset as f superscript 0. The don't care set we'll be denoting as either f star or f dc, interchangeable. Now, going back to implicants and covers, what we talked about in the previous slide, implicants and covers of a function may include don't care vertices. They just cannot include offset vertices, but they can include don't care vertices. It's okay to have don't care vertices in a cube, in an implicant of a function, and therefore also in a cover of a function. For example, here the implicant shown, the cube shown here, which is nothing but A, is an implicant of the function because it contains onset vertices and don't care set vertices. Okay. And this cover consisting of these two cubes is also a valid cover of the function. Okay. We will also now define a new concept called prime implicants and covers constituted of prime implicants. An implicant of F is prime if it is not contained in any other implicant of F. Intuitively, a prime implicant is as large as possible. If you expand it in any way, you will get into the offset of the function. So, for all other cubes that contain this prime implicant, those cubes will contain at least one offset vertex. If you take a cube which is a superset of a prime, a strict superset of a prime, and add it to the function, add that set of vertices it contains to the onset of the function, you change the function. It's not the original function anymore. So again, intuitively, a prime implicant is an implicant that is as large as possible. It's maximal in the sense that any superset of those vertices, if you expand it in any dimension, you will necessarily end up including at least one offset minterm. That's exactly the geometric interpretation. If you expand the cube in any dimension, you can expand the cubes by growing them in along one of the dimensions represented corresponding to the variables that are in the cube expression. Growing it in any dimension will make it include an offset vertex. For example, if you look at this set of the function AB or BC or AC, set of cubes are AB, BC, and AC. Take each of these cubes. If you try to expand them in any direction, if you expand this cube in the A dimension to try to make it include all four vertices, you are expanding into the offset. You are including the offset minterm there. Similarly, if you expand it along this dimension, again, you will be including the offset minterm. And the same is going to be true if you consider any of the other cubes as well. Okay. So AB, therefore, is a prime implicant in F equals AB or BC or AC in this function. A cover is prime if all of the cubes, if each and every one of the cubes that it has, that constitute it, are all prime. So here is an example of a prime cover. Each of these cubes, as we saw, is prime because expanding it in any dimension would end up covering, making it cover one of the offset vertices. And therefore, it is not an implicant of the function anymore. Okay. So this is an example of a cover that contains, that is composed only of prime implicants. A prime cover contains all of its cubes are prime. There is a related but different concept known as an irredundant cover. Okay. What is an irredundant cover? Well, an irredundant cover is something that does not have any useless cubes, right? A cover, again, is a collection of cubes. And F can also be written as a sum of products expression, which is the OR of all those cubes. A cube is irredundant if removing it will actually change the function. Removing it from the cover will make that cover no longer a valid cover for the function. So, in other words, none of these, with respect to this cover, none of these cubes are actually useless. They are all needed. They are necessary. For example, again, taking the function AB or AC or BC, if you remove AB, which is essentially the cube here, if you remove AB, the function is, leaving only the cubes BC and AC, this particular min term here will no longer be covered, included in the cover. So therefore, the resulting cover, when you remove AB, is no longer a valid cover for the function. Therefore, AB is irredundant in this particular cover. A cover itself is irredundant if all its cubes are irredundant, right? So one of the cubes may be redundant or irredundant, and if all the cubes are irredundant, all of them are needed, then that entire cover is said to be irredundant. Intuitively, it means that this cover, you know, is minimal in some form. So question for you is this cover, the cover shown here, A, is it prime, and B, is it irredundant? Is this a prime cover? Remember, the definition of prime cover is all of the cubes in the cover are primes, are prime implicants of the function. So in other words, you cannot expand any of the cubes in any dimension without going into the offset. Is this a prime cover? No. Why not? Because the cube shown here on the top can be expanded to cover this entire plane, the set of four min terms shown here on the top. In other words, C equals 1, subplane of this Boolean, subspace of this Boolean space, and that will still be a valid implicant because you only expanded it to include a don't care, you have not included any offset vertex. Similarly, the implicant shown here, we can also be expanded to a larger implicant, and again only covering the don't care subset, remaining a valid cover. So this is not a prime cover because there's at least two of the implicants. In fact, all three of the implicants, this one can also be expanded in this direction. So none of these implicants are prime. But is it an irredundant cover? Yes, because dropping any of the implicants from the cover will now mean that there will be some of those onset minterms. For example, if you drop the implicant here, these two onset minterms are no longer covered by the cover, no longer represented by the cover. And remember, a correct cover for a function has to represent all the onset minterms. So this is an example of an irredundant cover, but a cover that is not prime. And I gave this example only to drive home, you know, the fact that these are two different concepts. Both of them are desirable concepts. You want prime because prime, as we will see, somehow corresponds to helps you derive a minimum cover. You also want an irredundant cover because that also, you know, intuitively, if you have additional cubes, that's only adding additional unnecessary hardware. You can knock that off and not changing the function. So that should be a good thing as well. So both being prime and irredundant are good things, but they're different from each other. Okay. We'll also look at a concept known as essential implicants. Essential prime implicants. A prime is essential if there exists a min term that is covered by that prime, but it's not covered by any other prime of the function. In other words, there is only one prime that covers this min term. Intuitively, you can think of the notion of essential prime implicant as being similar to an irredundant cube, but the irredundant cube was defined with respect to a cover. Essential prime is defined with respect to the set of all possible primes of the function. Okay, so if you take the set of all possible primes of the function, there is one, if there's a minterm, if you take a prime from that set, if there is one minterm that is covered only by this prime and nothing else in the set of all primes of the function, then that becomes an essential prime. So which of these primes do you think are essential? So you have three primes, 1, 2, 3. Which of these are essential? All three are essential. Any other answers? Why do you think all these three primes are essential? Go back to the definition. A prime is essential if there is a minterm that is only covered by that prime and no other prime of the function. You have to think in terms of all primes of the function, not just the primes in the cover that I've shown here. I have not shown you all the primes of the function here. Right? Yeah. Is this also a prime of the function? Even though it's not shown in the cover, it doesn't need to be there in the cover, but this is a prime of the function. Is this a prime of the function as well if you combine these two? Yes. Similarly, this is a prime as well. So if you take any of these primes, you can throw it off, and there'll be other primes, add other primes, which will cover the minterms that are no longer covered. Right? So none of these primes are essential primes for the function. And in fact, it is possible for functions to have zero essential primes. This is an example of a function that does not have any essential primes. Okay. Any questions about any of these concepts?
So
yes, Asad.
Can you show us an example of an essential prime geometrically? I mean, can you give us a hypercube and...
Oh, we will be looking at an example, actually, in a couple of slides. Okay. So do remind me if it's still not apparent and, yeah. Any other questions? Okay. Now we get to two-level minimization. So the big result in this area, as we said, was it started off with prime, with Quine, and his major result was this theorem. There exists a minimum cover for any Boolean function that is a prime cover. Sounds like a very simple statement. Actually, it's very profound if you think about it. Given any Boolean function, you're trying to find its minimum cover. Okay, there exists a minimum cover for this function that is prime. That is the theorem due to Willard-Quine. What does this mean? Or why is this useful? What it tells you is that if you are searching for the minimum cover, how do you find a cover? It is composed of implicants or cubes of the function, right? So before this theorem came about, what would you do if you were looking for the minimum cover? You would need to search, either explicitly or implicitly, search through all combinations of implicants, all subsets of the set of all implicants of the function. Right? So you take all implicants of the function, right, which are, you know, any cube that is falls within the onset of the function is its implicant. So take all possible implicants of the function, that is a set of all possible implicants. Take all subsets of that, the minimum subset, which is still a correct cover for the function, which covers all the onset vertices, would be your minimum cover. So intuitively, the complexity of the problem is defined by the number of implicants there are for a function, right? If you forget about primes, if you assume that this theorem did not exist, you need to consider the set of implicants of a function. And how many implicants are there for a function with n variables? How many cubes or how many implicants are possible in general for a function? So you have n variables, x1 to xn. Remember that what is a cube? It is a conjunction of literals, right? It's a literal can appear in a cube in positive form. Either it can appear in a cube as x1, or it can appear in the complemented form, x1 prime, or it may not appear at all. Because remember, a cube doesn't have to have all n literals or all n variables. That's a minterm. It's a special kind of cube. But a cube in general can have anywhere from 1 to n variables, right? So if you're trying to come up with how many different cubes can you come up with given n variables? For one variable, there is three possibilities. It appears in uncomplemented form, appears in complemented form, or does not appear at all. There is three possibilities. How many such variables do you have? N variables. So what are the total number of possibilities now? 3 power n. Exactly. Well, you know, there might be one or two trivial cases that you subtract out of this, but it's still essentially, for all practical purposes, 3 power n. That's a large number. If n is 1,000, is this a set that you can really think about and reason about? Pretty large, right? So, what Quine's theorem does for you is that it takes this large set. If you're interested in coming up with a minimum implementation of the function, you need to look at subsets of 3 power n, all possible subsets of this large set, and reason about which of them is the minimum. But what this does for you is that it says you don't need to look at implicants that are not prime. Because for any function, you're looking for a minimum cover, there always will be at least one cover which is prime that is going to be minimum. Remember that it does not say that the prime cover, the minimum cover has to be a prime cover. It says that there is one cover, minimum cover that is prime. So there may be multiple possible answers which are all minimum. But at least one of them is prime. And as long as you don't care about which of those, you just care about the minimality of the cover. You don't care about which minimum cover specifically you're getting. You can forget about all the 3 power n and say that I'll only restrict myself to some subset of these. So you have this space of 3 power n implicants of function. And what Quine does for you is that it somehow chops this into two parts, right? The ones that are prime, the ones that are not prime, and says that you don't need to worry about these. Just look at this part in order to come up with the minimum implementation of a function. Okay. So this reduces your search space from the set of all implicants of the function to the set of primes of a function. Right. So that's the major result due to Quine. As we saw, McCluskey took this concept and he turned it into a constructive procedure to actually perform two-level minimization. Given a function, this is a quick two-line description of McCluskey's algorithm. Find the set, the first step in Quine-McCluskey's algorithm is given a function f, qm of f, first step is find the set of all primes, right? This capital P is the collection of all primes, this, the union of pi, where pi is a prime of f. You have this set of primes p. Among the set of primes, then look for a minimum cover, right? A minimum subset of primes. Find a minimum subset of the set of primes that is still a valid cover for the function. And that is the minimum cover that you're looking for. Okay? So, this is intuitively, it's very simple, two steps, but of course, the complexity lies in efficiently performing each of these steps. Right? So, two major steps in Quine-McCluskey's algorithm are prime generation, generating the set of primes, and then minimum subset selection problem, which is selecting a minimum subset of the set of primes. That may, of course, you can say that I'll choose a minimum subset as an empty set, but it won't be a cover for the function. It has to be a valid cover. It has to cover all the onset min terms of the function. So before we go on to talk about the details of Quine-McCluskey, a very useful principle, you know, in the theorem by Quine, it actually embodies a very useful principle that is very useful in, you know, different aspects of, in various aspects of design automation. It's a recurring theme, so I thought I'd just put this down explicitly for you, right? Reduce the search space as much as possible before you even start the search, right? Why? Or how does the Quine theorem do that? Originally, your search space, the space in which you needed to search, was the set of all subsets of this 3 power n. And I haven't quantified the reduction. In fact, I'll leave that as a homework exercise to you, and we can briefly discuss it in the next lecture. But the set of all primes is much smaller in general than the set of all implicants. And so you have reduced the search space from 3 power n, or subsets thereof, to subsets of this smaller set of prime implicants. Okay? Exactly how small, you know, try to do some homework reading on that, and we'll talk about it. But the concept involved here is reduce the search space as much as you can, even before you start any search. And that's going to pay you rich dividends. Okay. we'll look at the two steps in Quine-McCluskey in reverse order, right? The two steps, remember, are generating the set of all primes, selecting minimum subset of primes. Let's imagine somehow that you generated all primes. Okay, we'll talk about that later. First, we'll start off by talking about the second part, which is how do you select the minimum subset of primes. In order to do that, we define what is known as the covering table. This is, you can think of this as a data structure or a something that helps you keep track of this minimum subset problem. So what you do is, what is a covering table? Well, a covering table captures the relationships between primes and minterms. What it does is it represents all the primes of the function as columns of the covering table. Okay, so you have all these columns, P1, in this case, P1 through P8. These are the 8 primes of the function. It's just an example, arbitrary example I picked. And in this case, I also coincidentally picked the function to have 8 onset minterms. So the rows of the covering table are the onset minterms that are in the onset of the function. Okay. So again, the columns of the covering table represent the primes of the function. The rows of the covering table represent the onset minterms of the function. The entries of the table are 0 or 1, depending on whether that particular minterm is covered by the prime or not. For example, if you look at prime P1, corresponding to the first column, you see that minterm M1 is covered by the prime, minterm M2, onset minterm M2 is covered by the prime, and M3 to M8 are not covered by the prime. So any prime is, or any implicant or cube for that matter, is nothing but a collection of minterms. You just see which of these minterms are included in that set, and thereby you can populate the entries of this table. Okay. So given the set of all primes and the onset minterms, it's trivial to actually construct this table. So what we need to do now is essentially select the set of minimum subset of primes, minimum subset of columns, such that all the onset minterms are covered, or each of the onset minterms is covered by at least one of the primes that you have selected. And that is known as a covering problem. It's a very fundamental problem in computer science. It's the covering problem. So you need to find the minimum subset of the columns in that covering table that covers all the rows. And a column is said to cover the row if the entry, a column j covers row I, if that entry in the table tij is 1. And as I mentioned, this is actually an NP-complete problem. Okay, it's defined very simply, but solving it exactly, finding an optimum solution in polynomial amount of time that is polynomial in the size of the covering table, is it's extremely difficult, and believe, you know, there is no currently known polynomial time algorithm to solve it. How do you do this exhaustively? Well, the brute force technique essentially could proceed as follows. Consider all the elements in the set of primes, right, in the columns. Consider all columns. Each column may either be excluded or included in the cover, in your minimum cover. And consider all possible combinations. How many are there? 2 power number of columns, right? Cardinality of P, 2 power number of columns. So that is, intuitively, you can also represent these combinations as a search tree where you pick one prime, start off with, let's say, P1, and say that P1, you know, there's 2 possibilities. Either P1 is part of your minimum cover or it's not. There's only 2 possibilities, right? So that corresponds to the 2 branches of this search tree. The search tree just represents the different possible combinations of primes that you can include in the cover or not. And each path of through the search tree, once you reach the leaf, so for each case of P1 being in the cover or not, you can take another prime P2 and say now P2 is either going to be in the cover or not. And once you enumerate all possible cases, again, you have 2 power n leaves. The leaves of the search tree correspond to the 2 power n combinations of or subsets of these primes. Each of those you can evaluate and see, is this a valid cover for the function or not? Right? In other words, are all the rows covered? And look at all the leaves that are valid covers for the function. And among those leaves, look at the one which has fewest primes. Right? And that will be the answer. You could do that, but that is going to require order of 2 power number of primes runtime, because, you know, you explicitly are enumerating all 2 power n combinations. So you certainly need to do better than that. You'd like to do better than that. And that's exactly what, you know, our preceding discussion is going to be about. How do you select a subset of primes? McCluskey did not really address this except for providing some hints as to how you might simplify this problem, reduce the search space from 2 power p to something smaller, but he did not give a complete algorithm for solving that. And that's exactly what we are going to be discussing now. Next. Okay. So I think this is a good point to stop. We'll continue the discussion in the next lecture. But any questions thus far about the what we discussed earlier or about the column covering formulation of this problem? Okay, if not, I'll see you in the next lecture.